this morning. Our topic is that of coronary proneness. This means the likelihood that you have, because of various things in your past history, that make you more susceptible to having a coronary heart attack. Coronary heart attack is, of course, the stoppage of one of your major arteries to the heart, the major arteries being called coronary vessels. The reason they're called coronaries is because they crown the heart. So that if you look at the heart, actually, it sets in the heart, it sets in the chest like this. Your heart is about the size of your loosely clenched fist, turned upside down like this, and at the top we call that the base, but actually we also call it the crown, and the coronaries run around it like that and then come down over the muscle in this fashion. And if one of those, any one of those, gets stopped up, then you can get a coronary heart attack, or what we call a myocardial infarction, or a little death of the muscle in that place. Ever thereafter, you will have no electrical impulse that goes through that area. It has to go around it. And, of course, that makes the heart a little less efficient. So anytime you've had some loss of the muscle, it is not good for your heart. It makes it function in a not good way. Consequently, we want to avoid injury to the heart if we can. If you are a heavy exerciser and you leave off exercise for a number of days, let's say 10 days, then you decide, I've got time now, I'm going to go back and pick up my exercise. And so you do that, but you start at the same level that you were at when you stopped, and it puts a strain on the heart. And you may lose a few muscle fibers, maybe not many, but you'll lose a few muscle fibers. And as time goes by, it can cause an electrical imbalance in the heart muscle, which makes it so that you may get some rhythm disturbances of some kind. Or you may have a little less complete closure of the heart muscle when it closes. Normally, when the heart closes like this, it closes just like this. If you were just like my squeezing my hand together, just like this. And if you were to put your hand down in a bucket of blood and squeeze your hand together and bring your hand out and open your hand up in this way, how much blood would be in your palm? None. That's exactly the way it is with the heart. There is none left in the heart when it gets through doing its squeezing like this. It has squeezed it all out. Then with a wonderful set, two different kinds of valves, we have the ability to stop the backflow of blood. Two of the valves, the mitral and the tricuspid, are valves that are supported by cords, and the pulmonic and the aortic are cusps, which are just like little cups, and they are supported only on the edges. It's a marvel of anatomic engineering. And every time I see the human heart, of course, it's just muscle and fibrous tissue and nerves and blood vessels. That's all it's made of. It's not complex like the liver, which has systems of vessels and systems of cells all doing different functions. Very simple, but so beautifully made. And, of course, we're totally dependent on it. A good circulation underlies all good health. If you do not have a good circulation, then your health will not be good, because your blood must bathe directly or indirectly every cell of your body. It must refresh it. It must nourish it. It must oxygenate it. It must make it so that it is capable of doing its function. And consequently, the care that we give to the heart and to its own blood supply is essential to your well-being. Now, so essential it is that if you begin to develop heart and artery disease, you may get a backache from your arterial disease. A lot of people feel that their backaches are caused by overstrain, But that's a very small part of the problem. It is a part of the problem, it's true. But if you have a good blood supply to your joints, the joints in the back, the bones in the back, the ligaments and the capsules that support the back, you will not have so much problem with back problems. And consequently, to have good blood vessel supply to the bones and the discs and the joints and the joint cavities and the joint capsules, this is essential in order that you would have good functioning bones. Far more people have knee problems because they aren't getting enough blood to the area, circulation in some way, than that they are overstraining the knee. It's true that we can overstrain the knees and have a problem with that. But if we have a good circulation of blood, then we're unlikely to have as much problem as we would otherwise have. Now, if you will turn in the handout packet that you've been given to a section called coronary risks. Coronary risks. You will see that it should be four pages. Let's take the first page. On the first page, you will see a number of causes of heart attacks. Notice the first three, an elevated blood cholesterol, smoking, and high blood pressure. If you have all three of these, this gives you a 30% chance of dying within the first 20 minutes of feeling your first heart pain within the next 10 years after these have first been diagnosed. Now, there are a number of other things that increase your risk of getting a heart attack, being overweight, having diabetes. And I mentioned yesterday about the fact that diabetes increases the or causes fluctuations in insulin. Insulin is far more irritating to blood vessels than sugar. So the high blood sugar does not cause the damage to the blood vessels that insulin causes. Insulin is a very powerful substance. We only need tiny amounts of it. And when we eat a great load of sugar, pancreas looks at this great load of sugar and says, ah, we'd better dump out a whole carload of insulin. And so it does just that. And the insulin level goes high. Well, your blood sugar comes right down to normal. So when we test your blood sugar, it's perfectly normal in the laboratory. But it did so at the expense of this high insulin level, which then irritated your blood vessels. Diabetes should be called, should be named, not diabetes, but accelerated aging. Need to go one step farther on that. People who have a background of diabetes in their family are born with an accelerated aging plan. They're born with it. Therefore, if you have diabetes in your family, you need to identify the fact that you do have it, if you can, and then live as if you were now a known diabetic. A known diabetic now. Because we see that in the relatives of people who have diabetes, that their release of insulin is typical of the diabetic. Their response to carbohydrate is typical of that of the diabetic, even though they don't have diabetes. And they don't yet have the complications, but they're more likely to get the complications of diabetes, even without the diagnosis. Difficulties with the eyesight, difficulties with the extremities and the blood vessels, and of course, an increased rate of hardening of the arteries. Here's another one, inadequate exercise. Exercise will cure a lot of other ailments. It pours oil on a lot of troubled waters if we get plenty of exercise. That's physiologically speaking. And so you need to have a plan now of exercise. So when you're young, when most of us would enjoy playing things like basketball and football and tennis and handball, all fast sports, we enjoy those when we're young. But the time when you really need it is when you're about 40. Well, then you haven't developed any skills and have no equipment for good types of exercise that would really keep you in good health when you're 40 and plus. And you have to quit playing these fast ones because your eyes and your feet and your muscles won't keep up with that kind of high pace. And consequently, most people who are fast athletes in their youth aren't athletes at all by the time they get to be 40. So select when you're young some kind of exercise that you will enjoy. For me, gardening is it's my cup of tea. We have a large garden and I can spend from 1 to 2 hours in it every day. And that keeps me in good physical condition because you use every muscle in the body in doing gardening, the various activities that are involved in doing gardening. For me, that's better than a non-productive type just because of my personality. My type of personality is the kind that if something is not productive, I'm not likely to stick with it very long. So walking, I love to walk, but it's not coercive like the garden. You have to get out there because the weeds are growing. You have to go there because it's got to be watered. You've got to harvest. You've got to pull the suckers out or something else has to happen. And so it has a coercive quality to it. Many times I'm an introvert by heart. I'd rather do what's on the inside than what's on the outside. So if I didn't have something that was a little compelling, I would enjoy those things that are on the inside and play the instruments, or I would do the cooking or do some sewing. I love those kinds of things that are all sedentary, but I need the gardening, do you see? Select something that fits your personality, and that will be somewhat coercive if you need it. Another thing that I have done through the years is to have an exercise partner. That's also coercive. And the exercise partner comes to my house for the exercise. We start from my house. So that, there have been many times, especially when my office was in my home, when I would, the time when I got my walking shoes on was when I saw her come by the window. Oh, got to go. Well, you need to do whatever is necessary to ensure that you get exercise every day. I suppose I could probably not give you any better counsel than that. And in all the counsel that I give to you, if you will learn to exercise, that will do more for you than any other single thing besides diet change. Next thing is a low vital capacity. We need to learn to stand erect and sit erect. When we lie in bed, we need to lie in a good position, in a good alignment. And don't lie in the same position all the time. If you always lie on your right side, then it's going to put a strain on the back. And one of these days when you heave yourself out of bed, ooh, and you're stuck in that position. Because for the last 30 years, you've been getting out of bed in the same way, and it's eventually taken its toll on your back. A low vital capacity means how much you can blow out after you have taken a full inspiration. You should, from time to time, simply take a deep breath. Just that resets your thermostat in your brain that controls your breathing rate and breathing depth. And so if you will breathe occasionally a very deep breath, that will help you to help the center in the brain that controls this to have a little more air hunger and will help you to breathe a little more deeply. Oxygen is also very necessary to keep ourselves from getting injury, the kind of injury that leads to hardening of the arteries. A friend of mine said that most Americans breathe only enough to keep them from fainting. Poor posture is one of those causes, is one of the causes of that, because we get very hunched over. And when we get, as we get older, certain muscles begin to contract a little. Did you know that? So we get stiff. You may have once been able to put your hands flat on the floor and you can't do that anymore. I don't recommend that you do it, by the way. That's people who are so anatomically constructed that they can do that. It's fine for them, but don't strain to do it. That could put a strain on your back if you aren't constructed so that you can naturally do that. But you may have noticed that you aren't as limber as you once were. You can't reach quite as far. you can't stretch as much. This is because muscles tend to contract. And the reason that they do is because we don't use them as much. Therefore, you need to do some stretching exercises once in a while. And that will help you. The muscles of the chest become contracted. And when they become contracted, the shoulders go forward like this. Do you see? They just go forward. They try to meet in the middle. Well, it doesn't take very long of trying to meet here in the front before you're going to get a little bit of a forward head. Okay, you put a forward head and shoulders that are coming forward, and pretty soon the back is going to be a little humped on the top, isn't it? And then pretty soon you've got a hump back. So we don't want that. So from time to time, every woman especially, because humpback is more common to women, every woman needs to do a good stretching exercise with them to stretch out the muscles of the chest. Now, I'd like you to do that right now. Would you just put your arms up in front of you just like this? And then, just as if you were going to cross your arms, but as far out as you can get them. And then, just separate your hands and pull your elbows straight back and meet your elbows in the back. Can you do that? Meet your elbows right in the back. Okay. Can't quite do that, and nobody really quite can. And then another one. From the same position, reach forward just like this. Raise your hands up like that. Now go back as far as you can. Again, stretch back. Try to meet your hands in the back just like that. Of course, you can't do that either because we're not supposed to do that. Then, and you do it slowly and don't let it hurt you because if your tendons and so forth aren't all warmed up to it, you could get a little strain in a ligament there, so I should have warned you about that beforehand. But the position that your arms are in when you have done that, it's better to do that, of course, standing up, both of those. The position that your arms are in, shoulders back and down, that's the correct position for the shoulders. Now, to get the neck in a proper position, then to do that, you need the cheekbones right over the collarbones. Most of us have a forward head because we're constantly doing this kind of thing, looking, straining at something that's small, and that gives us a forward head. That puts a strain on the neck. Has anybody ever tried to balance a broom on your finger, broom stick on your finger? You can do it nicely as long as the broom stands straight up, can't you? But when the broom starts going over like this, it takes both hands to hold it, doesn't it? Almost. It's the same thing with the neck. As long as the neck is in its proper position, which we call the neutral position, the cheekbones right over the collarbones, it's easy to hold the head up. But when you get it over like this, it puts a strain on the neck muscles. And that's what gives a lot of neck pain. Now, if you get the neck in a proper alignment, the shoulders in a proper alignment, almost everything else will automatically go into place, except perhaps for the knees. We need a little curve in the back. For 50 years, we taught that you should sort of try to make a C shape out of the back, like this, with a bent sort of like a cat bows the back when they're angry. Now we know that humans don't do that way very well. We need to have a little arch in the back, right at the waist. And so it's all right for you to have a little arch there. Too much is, of course, not good, but not enough is also not good. So if you get that little arch in the back, and then relax the knees so that the knees sort of relax forward. They're not locked backward in a hyperextended position, but just sort of relaxed. And if you have to stand and talk or wash dishes or whatever, you'll move just a little bit, or just from time to time just move the knees. Then the only other thing to have good posture is to remember to stand on the outsides of the feet and not pronated on the ankles like this or on the arches. You want to stand on the outside of the feet. If you'll get in this position, you can stand for hours without fatigue, except for your feet. They'll get tired. But you should be able to stand without any pain. You should be able to walk. A lot of people take a walk and they come back with shoulders aching. The reason for that is they've been walking like this. Well, if you if you hold your neck out front like that, your head out front, then of course it's going to be, it's like the broomstick, it's going to be hard to hold it up. So all of these are good to give you a high vital capacity. Learning how to stand and breathe and even talk in a proper way will help you to have a good vital capacity. That's good for the heart. The heart is helped if you have a good vital capacity or good big lungs. High intake of sugar or refined grains, it increases your risk. Pulse over 80, stressful lifestyle, hereditary predisposition. The use of alcohol. Alcohol damages every cell it touches. Now, most of us are teetotalers. But most of us probably form some alcohol in the gastrointestinal tract. I wish I could tell you that it's the nice beverage alcohol like ethyl alcohol, but it isn't. It's some of the very damaging kinds of alcohol like isopropyl and propyl and methyl. These are very damaging alcohols. They damage the delicate structures of the eyes and ears and balance and so forth. So, and one of the big reasons for that is eating between meals, eating too much, eating too great a variety at a meal. Things that you will learn from Councils on Diet and Foods, page 100. If you don't have that book, go by the ABC store. They have it, and they will supply your need. So do not produce alcohol if you can avoid it. Then coffee, even decaffeinated. Now, some of the causes of high blood cholesterol, there are dietary causes. You can read all those. They are pretty well known. One that may be not so well known to you or may not have struck you as important is that of the lack of fiber. A lack of fiber is important to us in many ways. If you have a lack of fiber, then toxic substances like cancer-producing agents, which we eat with our food or we produce in the body, cancer-producing agents can be attached by the fiber and taken out of the intestinal tract in the refuse, provided we've got plenty of fiber. Many Americans only have 3 to 8 grams of fiber a day when they need to have about 60. We persist in using white bread and white crackers and white refined cereals and refined rice when we could have the whole grain variety. We need this. We need the whole grain variety. So we should be very careful to provide this for us. Eat plenty of fruits and vegetables. A few nuts and seeds. We don't need a lot. Everybody should have some every day. It's been shown that people who take a little handful, don't scoop up with your hand like a shovel. Put your hand in and close the fist over it like this. That's the handful that you need. With a palm down, not with the palm up when you get your handful, a little handful. That's what we need in the way of nuts and seeds. Measured in measurement would be about an ounce. 1 ounce of nuts or seeds, like sunflower seeds. Walnuts are high in omega-3. You've heard of that in relation to the fish oils. Well, don't take the fish oils, because fish oils have been shown to increase your risk of getting stroke. But nothing's wrong with walnuts, and they're very high in the omega-3 fatty acids as well. All right, let's look at some general factors that are causes of high blood cholesterol. You can see some of these that we've already mentioned. And notice tension, noise, and television. These are all associated with an increased risk of getting high blood cholesterol. Now, in relation to this, although it's not actually mentioned here, is poor air, especially a low circulation of air in your bedroom at night. You need to have fresh air in your bedroom at night. Many people wake up in the morning with a morning headache because they don't get enough fresh air during the time they're sleeping. Now, why a diet low in fat and cholesterol can help you. There are a number of things there, some of which I've already referred, and I will skip that part and go on to the diet. Diet to lower cholesterol. If you're even 10 pounds overweight, you have a greater likelihood of getting high cholesterol as well as high blood pressure. And sometimes people need to lose this extra amount in order to get the cholesterol down. Some people can carry a little extra weight and seem to feel better and do better with a little extra weight. Some people do better with less weight. If your fat is located in the abdomen, there is a premium on losing the weight even if you're thin elsewhere. You may be thin in the face and thin in the neck and thin in the chest, but come to the abdomen and you've got a little tummy. This encourages the syndrome that I talked about yesterday, the syndrome X, with the quintuplets of hypertension, diabetes, high blood cholesterol and triglycerides, especially LDL, high LDL and low HDL, high triglycerides and overweight and cancer. Those five go together. They are quintuplets called syndrome X, dubbed about 20 years ago by some researchers in Texas, I believe it was. Now, a word about losing weight. Okay, let's say that I'm 50 pounds overweight. I attend a good health class and I'm inspired. I want to lose this weight. So I go home and I every morning for breakfast I have half an apple. Every morning for lunch I have 3 carrot curls and 2 pieces of celery. And for supper, I drink a cup of herb tea. And I keep that up for about 3 weeks. And I lose a lot of weight. Then one night, in the middle of the night, I have this little vague pain over here in my right side, up high. I turn over, and it's still there. And I stretch, and it's still there. I do everything I know to do. I drink some water. It's still there. It gets worse. Now it starts coming in waves, and I get nauseated with it. And I start vomiting, and I've got this terrible pain. This pain that's so bad that by now I can't even lift my head off the pillow nor turn without increasing my pain a lot. And you add to that retching and vomiting when you don't want to even move and you have to move to do the retching and vomiting. And you've got a great distress. What is my diagnosis? What? Gallstones. Gallstones. What caused it? The rapid weight loss. So, don't lose weight rapidly. I had a patient one time who was a good bit overweight and wanted to marry a young lady. She was very disappointed in his weight, and so she complained about it. So he said, well, that's no problem. I'll just lose it. And so he lost about 35 pounds in about 6 weeks and ended up in the hospital in a distant state to get his gallbladder taken out because he had a case of acute cholecystitis. So don't lose weight fast. The first week you can lose as much as you can lose. You can even fast for a week and it won't harm you. I don't know that you should fast any longer than that. That is if you're healthy and everything is fine otherwise. We often have people who do that in the hospital. We just put them on IV fluids and a week may go by and we have their NPO or nothing by mouth. So you can fast for a week and no big problem. And you might lose 10 pounds. What is that? Is it 10 pounds of fat? No, it's generally water, a lot of water and some fat, but not a lot of fat. Then when you start eating again, you'll gain that back again if you don't watch. So the best thing to do is to lose whatever you wish the first week, but then after that you must settle down. The second week you can lose 2 pounds. But after that, if you've got a good bit to lose, I recommend about half a pound a week or a pound a week as your maximum. That would be 50 pounds in a year maximum. That's a lot of weight to lose in a year, isn't it? So I wouldn't lose any more than that. And 25 pounds in a year is far more reasonable and more helpful for the body. Puts a tax on the body to lose so much weight at one time. And the up and down, the yo-yo diets, is very, very taxing on the body. Very stressful to the body. Don't do that kind of thing. It's better that you stay fat than that you go up and down and up and down and up and down. All right, avoid these, and it tells you a number of things that you can avoid. The reason that you can avoid all these is that they are empty calories. Syrup, sugar, honey, molasses. Honey is not entirely empty, and or molasses and syrup, but it's empty enough. You don't need it. You don't. The body does not require it. And you can satisfy your sweet tooth. How would you satisfy your sweet tooth? I was born with a sweet tooth that was down to here somewhere. There you go. The sweet fruits, that satisfies your sweet tooth. And I can tell you how to really trim your sweet tooth right up to here. Here's the way to do it. Take a fruit meal for breakfast, a fruit meal for lunch. Have nothing for nothing for supper except some herb tea. Then the next morning for breakfast you have a fruit meal, and for lunch that day you have another fruit meal. The next day you do the same, two fruit meals. The next day, two more fruit meals. By the time Sabbath comes, you are ready for some savory foods. Your sweet tooth is right up to here. You don't want anything sweet. If you might try doing that, if sweets are your problem, you might try doing that and see if that will help you to get a hold on your appetite. Then some minimum basic needs on a therapeutic diet goes into that in that section. You can take a look at that. Soybeans have recently had some very good press as being helpful to the heart, to keep you from getting heart attacks, helpful to keep you from getting cancer, good for your blood pressure. By the way, also good for the blood pressure is celery. I have seen several patients who have had their blood pressure come right down to normal by taking three stalks of celery and pureeing it in a blender. All you have to do is just to put it in a blender on low speed. Just push it through like that. Take the next stalk and push it through, and the next stalk and push that through. Then the last one, you may need a spatula to do that. It's done in just a minute or less. And take that with each of two meals. If you don't take a supper, just take that as a little medicinal supper. And that can be then a fruit meal in the morning, then three stalks at lunch and three stalks at supper time. And that I've seen several patients who have been cured with that. It is also good for arthritis, but I've not seen any cases of arthritis that have gone into remission from celery. But it is helpful with that as well. Garlic will inhibit the formation of fats in the liver. That's the next paragraph. How much garlic do you need? Well, probably one clove per day of raw garlic would do it. One clove of raw garlic per day will also do more for you than one baby aspirin a day. Some of you may be taking baby aspirin to prevent a heart attack or to prevent a stroke. I don't recommend that. Aspirin has a lot of things that are not good. Aspirin works by poisoning your systems, not by encouraging a nutritive function in your body. And so what we want to do is, with garlic, there is an inhibition of the formation. It doesn't poison the system. It just acts to put the brakes on this system of the formation of fats in the liver. That's a good function. We have a number of foods that do that. There are a number of foods that will inhibit the functioning of the thyroid gland. For people who are low in thyroid, they'll need to avoid those. For people who have an over-functioning thyroid, they will need to use those foods, emphasize those foods in the diet. And a lot of other foods. I'll be talking more about that this afternoon, about how you can use foods as medicine for you. Okay, you can read the remainder of this section. I'd like you to go now to the last page. There are a number of things here. You will find them all very helpful to protect your heart, and I hope you will study those a lot. Study those carefully and make certain that you understand just what we mean by all of that. But I'd like you now to take a look on the back page. Let's talk about people who have done everything they know to get their cholesterol down. They've worked on their posture. They've made sure they have good circulation of air in the bedroom at night. They've changed their diet. They've lost the weight that they need to, and the cholesterol is still high. They're total vegetarians. Use no meat, milk, eggs, or cheese. They've stopped using any kind of sugar, honey, syrup, or molasses. They've done everything, and their blood cholesterol is still high. Some of you may be like that. I'm like that as well. That's my family background. And many of you may have the same kind of genetic background that you can do all of these things that we mentioned here, and your blood cholesterol is still higher than is desirable. Then there are some special things that you need to do, and it does not take clofibrate or some other pharmaceutical. There is no pharmaceutical for bringing the blood cholesterol down that does not have its injurious effects on the body. And an increase in gallbladder cancer is one of those things that some of these drugs have. I'm not a great one for giving any kind of drug, and certainly not to bring cholesterol down. So let's see if there are some natural things that we can do. Notice here that charcoal is recommended. Charcoal and cholesterol. A study reported in the British journal Lancet found that people with high blood cholesterol levels were able to bring their cholesterol level down 25%. Now, about the best that you can hope to do with some of the pharmaceuticals is maybe 15 milligrams, not percent, and this is 25%. Very good effect that charcoal will have on some people's cholesterol. I wish I could say it would do everybody in that way, but it won't do everybody that way, but you should give it a try, and it may be that it'll be helpful for you. The LDL, which is the harmful type of cholesterol, is especially helped with that. Triglycerides have been brought down as much as 45% with the use of charcoal in this way. Charcoal and garlic, and some people will need a little supplement of magnesium in order to bring their cholesterol down a little bit. It just seems to help somehow. I guess it relaxes and reduces stress in these people. Okay, now there may be several people who have questions. Would you raise your hands and I'll give you numbers now. Number one, number two, number three, number four, number five, number six, number seven, number eight, number nine. Oh, I think I've already gotten you. Number nine. Number one. Magnesium you can get in a pill form. It's very easy to take. It's more expensive than taking it as Epsom salts. Now, those of you who work in medicine will recognize that we have used Epsom salts in pregnancy for pregnant women to keep them from getting eclampsia or the toxicity of pregnancy. It's a very safe supplement, and it's cheap. You can get a quart of it for $5 or $6. Very cheap. You'll get a pint of pills for $20. which is, you know, not tightly packed like salts are, the Epsom salts. And then what you need to do with the Epsom salts is to take it until you begin to get diarrhea, loose stools. And when you start getting loose stools, then you drop back and to the point that you don't get loose stools. And that's the dosage that you should take for high blood pressure and to bring your cholesterol down and for any other cause that you might be taking it. Some people have chronic constipation because of being low in magnesium. Apparently, some people don't take up magnesium as well as other people do. And when we check diabetics, almost 100% of diabetics will be magnesium deficient in their tissues. And so apparently there is something about diabetic proneness that makes it so that they don't take up magnesium well. Now with the tablets, you can start off, it depends on how sensitive your intestinal tract is. If it's not very sensitive or if you have chronic constipation, I'd start with a teaspoonful once a day. If that causes no noticeable effect on the bowels, then I'd do a teaspoonful twice a day. Then if that still causes no noticeable problem, a teaspoonful three times a day. What's the best way to take it? Well, somebody told me to stir it in a big glass of water. And it tasted bad every swallow. So what I recommend is that you simply take whatever dose you're going to and put it on the back of the tongue and swallow it, and then swallow some water after that. Then you only have for a few seconds, 2 or 3 seconds, you have the taste of the Epsom salts. It's not all that bad, but it's... with the pills, it's 300 to 500 milligrams of magnesium salts a day. Okay, question number 2. Yes?
How long is activated charcoal good for?
Activated charcoal, the question is, how long is it good? It never stops being good. You can pass it down as an heirloom to your children if you still have it. But keep it... There's no shelf life on it. Keep it dry, and it's fine. You see, it is pure carbon. And it does not react with the air except to adsorb it. It does not make a chemical reaction. It's just like a diamond. There are three forms of pure carbon: diamond, charcoal, and graphite that we write with in lead pencils. Those are all pure carbon. The reason they look different is because the structure, sort of crystalline structure, is different in all three of them. And so with the charcoal, it has no regularity. With diamonds, it's very regular, just like this. With graphite, it has a sort of a fishbone type of arrangement of the molecular pattern. And with charcoal, it's just what we call amorphous, or without form. So it has no shelf life. Keep it dry. Question number 3.
What's the word on avocados?
What is the word on avocados? Avocados are high in fat, so are olives high in fat. It's a very good quality of fat. My only problem with avocados is that they are expensive and not all that available. I wish they were available the year round. Then everybody should have a little every day. It'd be good for them. If you eat too much avocado, it has a laxative effect, so you don't want to eat too much. I'd love to live in a country where I could eat too much. And olives are also good. We are told by inspiration that olives are good for the digestion. Olives are also good for the kidneys. Olives are good for people with tuberculosis. So they're very good for you. What's the dosage of olives? Well, it depends on how much you weigh, but if you have a gastrointestinal problem, let's say you've got a peptic ulcer, then you'll need to take at least 8, but if you're overweight, don't take any more than 8. If you're thin, then you could take maybe 15 or 20 at a meal. Question number 4, is it now?
When is the best time to take charcoal? Can you take it daily?
When is the best time to take it, and can you take it daily? Underlying this question is, does it take up your nutrients? Is that what you really are driving at? It does not take up your nutrients. Somehow, the Lord has given us a very fine product in charcoal. It's a therapeutic product. It is almost what is called the ideal drug. When I was taking pharmacology in medical school, pharmacologists said there was no such thing as an ideal drug. An ideal drug is one that does no harm. It never misses to cure. It can be used by the illiterate and has no side effects of any kind. Charcoal almost fits that bill. Its major drawback is its messiness. And you have to, don't even open the jar unless you're over a sink. And always have a dark dress on when you open the jar. And if you're dealing with it the first time, plan to make a mess because you cannot believe how light the powder is if you've never dealt with it before. It's a very light powder. No, what you need to do is take it when you first get up in the morning, mid-morning, mid-afternoon, at bedtime. That's when you take it. It, of course, is not a food. Question number 5. Can you take charcoal with juice? Yes, you can. Juice interferes with its action. It does not take up the juice, but the juice, you have to take more of the charcoal to get the same effect. Is horseback riding an exercise? It certainly is. It's a nice exercise. Very good. It shouldn't be your only exercise, but it is a nice exercise. Question number 6. Number 6. Yes. Okay. Number 7. Brown rice. The fiber content of white rice and brown rice. And the quick cooked brown rice. Quick cooked brown rice has the same fiber content, I believe. May not have the same nutrient value because we lose in nutrient value with every type of processing. We lose about 5% of nutrient value even if our processing is not to take away. But grinding makes us lose about 5%. If you toast your bread, you lose about 5% of the nutrients. But as my husband says, you've still got 95% left. And the way most of us eat, that's plenty. Question number 8. Or is it 9? 8. Okay. Garlic pills do work. Most of the research has been done on the aged garlic extracts, most of the research. And by the way, there is a plethora of research done nowadays on garlic. And if a physician has not been keeping up with it, he will not understand your enthusiasm for garlic. But it's all through the medical literature. 15 years ago, you'd look in a search program for garlic and find one article per year on garlic. Now you'll find 10 articles per month on garlic, published in the standard medical literature. It's a very good product, and it's getting a lot of research now. It has an anti-clotting factor. It has the anti-platelet stickiness factor. That's why it's good for you instead of aspirin. And I wish somebody would research and find out just exactly how much people could take instead of dicumarol or Coumadin, which is the anti-clotting agents that we give in heart attacks. But yes, you can use the pills. The worst kind to use is the dry powdered form that we use in cooking. It has the worst odor, but the least effect on the body. And besides that, you don't know how old it is. You need to get the freshest garlic that you can if you use a pill or a capsule or tablet. Is weight training enough exercise? It probably is not. You still would need some walking with it. Cold extremities? Uh-huh. Okay. Let me tell you what to do for cold extremities. I used to have cold extremities. I thought women were born with cold feet and that they kept them all their lives, but that is not true. When I was in medical school, my professor of cardiology said if your patient's wife has warmer feet than her husband, the husband has bad arteries. But now my feet are just as warm as my husband's. and he doesn't have arterial disease. But the thing that has happened is that I have learned to clothe my extremities. And you must learn to do that. What gives you warm feet? Is it putting on socks? No, that will simply insulate your icicles down there. What you must do is to put a good clothing on your thighs. and knees. The knees are very sensitive. You have some large vessels that are very close to the surface behind the knees. And so if the thighs and knees are not warm, then as the blood is pumped from the heart, let me state it this way. If the thighs and knees are losing heat, they may be warm, but they're losing heat, then the blood will have no warmth when it gets down to the feet. So they get down to the blood gets to the feet. It cannot warm the feet, so the feet get cold. Then, because the feet are cold, the blood vessels clamp down to the feet and it shunts blood by some of its collaterals back up to the heart, and you get a situation that may make you have cold feet for hours because of big collateral vessels that start carrying the blood back to the heart. You've got warm thighs and warm knees, but it's at the expense of the feet. So if you will prevent heat loss in the thighs and knees, you can get good warmth there. Now, what about the person who has done all that and they still have cold feet? Their ankles are warm, but their feet themselves are cold. Hands and wrists are warm, but the hands are cold. Then you check the moisture of the hands and the palms and the soles. And usually you'll find that they are tense people with moist palms. And, of course, they're going to be cold. And there are ways that you can treat sweaty palms and sweaty feet. If anybody wants to learn how to do that, I'll be happy to tell you how. But see me afterward. It takes a little too long to explain. Question? Was that all? Overeating, yes, and I'm going to, I'll have something to say about that in my last 15 minutes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, question number 10, is it?
Nine.
Was that the last one? Okay, number 8. Do we have a 9? Is distilled water all right? Yes, it is. You will hear it said that there are no minerals in distilled water, but that's all right. We're not dependent on water for minerals, but rather on vegetables, fruits, and grains for minerals, and nuts and seeds. And so distilled water is pure, soft water. We're told by inspiration that our water should be pure and soft, and that would be about the ultimate. Water filters are all right. Did I give you the 800 number that you can call to get information, free information on this 1-800-TAKE-CARE? And the man who runs this service, I understand, is just a... it's possible he may be handicapped. I'm not sure. Physically handicapped and uses his funds and time to do this benevolent service. But it is free, so I understand. He's not selling anything, so forth. It does. Just leave it off. It's not necessary. Yes?
Just a comment on that water, bottled water. I bought some pure water, and it's got baking soda in it.
Oh, yes. Do not buy mineral water, because if you buy mineral water, it's going to have salt in it that you do not want. Baking soda is what is usually put in it. It's pure water with baking soda put in it. Okay. Did we get all the questions that were numbered? One more. Okay.
I want to know, you were saying, people say to me, well, you don't eat meat. What about these vegetables that are sprayed?
Okay. We try to, the question is about eating vegetables that are sprayed. Don't eat meat, but isn't it just as bad to eat all these sprayed vegetables? And the answer is no. Because the cattle also eat sprayed vegetables, and they store in their bodies the pesticides and herbicides and whatever that they eat on their silage or their grains that have the pesticides and so forth put on them, and their bodies store this up so that when you compare meat to vegetables, it's about 100 to 1. So it's almost 100 times more exposure to pesticides in animal products, meat, milk, eggs, and cheese, than in vegetable products like fruits and vegetables and whole grains, nuts, and seeds. Okay, I've got two more questions. I'll take these two more, and then I want to present some new material. I'll take your question, and then there was a question here. Here, there. Uh-huh. Yours first. Comment?
I found that if you take 1 gallon of water daily,
yes,
your body will stay warm.
Okay. Good point. Good point. If your extremities are cold, one of the reasons for it is that your blood vessel system may not be fully filled out with fluid. Drink an adequate quantity of fluid. I mentioned this yesterday, that the quantity of fluid that you should take is enough to cause the urine to be pale. Not entirely colorless, but pale. And our brother here suggests 1/2 gallon a day. For some people, that may be just right on. For some people, it won't be quite enough. So you have to study yourself and find out what is enough for you. That may be a little too much for some people. But you need to have a lot of water. We need a lot of water. And we get more allergies if we don't get enough water. Peptic ulcer has been shown to be due to one of the causes of peptic ulcer is not drinking enough water. While we're on that subject, another cause of peptic ulcers is not chewing your food enough. So chew your food. Now, I want to talk just a little bit about some other matters and have 11 minutes left. So I will. I want to cover all of this quickly, and I missed your question. Sorry. Yes. Vitamins. Yes. I covered this yesterday. I had a good little section on it. Would you get the tape on that? And I talked about the balance of various nutrients and the hazards of taking supplements on a long-term basis. So they have a tape available. American Cassettes has a tape, and camp meeting here has a tape, and so you should study that so that you can get an understanding of what my opinion is about taking supplements. Now, as I mentioned in the beginning, I can only present to you my opinion. I cannot present to you what is. Let me state that another way. I wish that I knew for absolute certainty that everything I always tell people is the absolute undeviating truth. I am always very mindful of the fact that an angel is listening to every word I say. An angel knows what is the absolute undeviating truth. And I really wish that I could be absolutely certain on some of these. Some of these things I cannot be absolutely certain on because there's not enough research done to make me have enough information that I can be absolutely secure that what I'm telling you is correct. And we have nothing by inspiration. But what we do have by inspiration concerning supplements is this, and that is that concentrated nutrients should be taken sparingly. Well, if there ever is a way that we could get concentrated nutrients, it is as supplements. With vitamin C, we can take 20 times the daily dose in one pill, do you see? And so we can very quickly get overloaded on nutrients. And so I do recommend caution. I have studied this as much as I know how, both from the standpoint of inspiration as well as well-done scientific research. And that's my opinion, that we should take nutrients only sparingly, just a little. Okay, I'd like to review quickly the cancer proneness profile, which we went over yesterday. The reason for that is that you will notice why in just a moment. Carbohydrate metabolism defects, like with blood sugar problems and diabetes, weight, overweight either now or as a teenager, the use of the brown drinks, coffee, tea, colas, and chocolate, alcohol consumption, being taller for women, taller than 5'6", weighing more than 140 pounds, increases your risk of getting cancer. For men also, the taller they are, above about 6 feet, the greater, the just increases their risk a little bit, but we don't have a specific figure as we do for women. Dairy consumption increases. It is known that dairy consumption increases breast cancer, ovarian cancer, and prostate cancer. For ovarian cancers, particularly the already fermented dairy products like yogurt, cream cheese, cottage cheese, and buttermilk. Then advancing age, spices increase the risk, especially of cancer of the stomach, cancer of the esophagus, and that is ginger, cinnamon, nutmeg, cloves, black and red pepper. All of those increase one's likelihood of getting cancer. And then all the coronary proneness items as well. Now let's go to the coronary proneness items. And here they are. Here is the coronary proneness profile. Number one is age and sex. As we get older, we're more likely to have a coronary. Men are more likely to have heart attacks than women. As the cholesterol and triglycerides go up, so does your risk, your proneness for having a coronary. As your blood pressure goes up, so does your risk for having a coronary. The weight, especially abdominal fat, blood sugar, as it goes up, that increases your risk. The ideal, what is the ideal that I gave you yesterday on blood sugar? Anybody recall offhand without referring to your notes? 70 to 85. That's right. 70 to 85. So check your... You need to get your annual laboratory test report yourself and look at it, because the computer will only give you average American. Average American is not ideal. Half of Americans are going to be dying in the next little while of coronary heart attacks. So we don't want to be average American. We want to be in the ideal range. And we have this published in our book, Nutrition for Vegetarians, on the very last page. Okay, the next one is uric acid level. The uric acid goes up when we have gout, but it also is involved in an axis that has to do with diabetes and coronary proneness. And we aren't entirely certain how uric acid fits into this picture. Just know that it tends to be elevated. So it's a marker for you. If it's up, if it's above 5, I like to see uric acid below 5 on the laboratory report. If it's above 5, it increases your proneness to having a coronary or a heart attack. Number 7, the diet. How much meat and cheese you use as compared to the vegetables. Vegetables are protective. Especially soybeans are protective for heart attacks, and broccoli is protective for cancer. Those aren't the only ones, and we'll be studying much more about this afternoon. And the next is the use of tobacco, drugs, and alcohol. They all increase your risk. Little physical activity, your EKG findings. From time to time, you should get an EKG just for a baseline. At least about every, if you're totally healthy, doing a good lifestyle, no symptoms of heart problems, at least every 10 years, I would say. Maybe even more frequently than that if you've got a family history of a problem with coronaries. Okay, now the Adventist Health Study was done a number of years ago. In the section that they studied, it was approximately half of Seventh-day Adventists eat no meat, poultry, or fish. As I travel around the country, I just have to say I wish it were true. I believe that it's not quite that high, that we don't have that many Adventists who are vegetarians. But I hope there is nobody in this class who goes away from camp meeting still eating meat. I hope you go away determined not to eat meat anymore, or cheese. Cheese is harmful to us now, and well, it always has been. But it's especially bad now, because it's we are now more susceptible to cancer and to heart disease than we have been. And cheese, being a fermented fat, makes it rancid, rancid fats are injurious to us, and we have too many other things that are injurious to us to add cheese. And of course, the Lord told us many years ago that it should never enter the human stomach. And so it's now high time. So go home with a new Year's resolution from camp meeting. Don't eat anymore. Be a vegetarian. Okay, the next one is, overall, Seventh-day Adventists live 7 years longer than the general population, but Seventh-day Adventists who are more adherent to the vegetarian diet live 12 years longer. And I think that the more things that you would add to that in addition to diet, the more healthfully you could live. Now, notice these coronary heart disease death rates of Seventh-day Adventists compared to the California population. Total vegetarians, that's no meat, milk, eggs, or cheese, 14% died with heart attacks. Lacto-ovo vegetarians went up to 39%. Meat included in the diet, 55%. This is well worth noticing, because to reduce your risks from 55% down to 14% is quite a lot of reduction in risk. Yes?
Maybe a lot of folks don't realize that the Agriculture Department suggested to the farmers raising beef cattle for human consumption that if they wanted to decrease the cost of production, they would see chicken legs to the animals.
Okay, the question is, statement is made that that nowadays cattle are fed, it was said chicken litter, but that's not the only litter they are fed now. They are fed other litter as well.
Now, I've done work for a farmer that was doing that.
Yes.
They
lied
on for at least 11, 12 years.
Yes. They're fed other bad things as well. You've heard of the mad cow disease. There's good evidence that the way that it got started was feeding sheep, dead sheep. Well, sheep aren't carnivorous animals. They're vegetarians. And to feed them flesh, even ground up and dried and in their grains, was not good. Okay, let's go on to the cancer death rate of Seventh-day Adventists compared to the California population. Total vegetarians, it's probably less than that. It's probably 2 to 3% now. Ovo-lacto-vegetarians, 25%. Meat included, 50%, or close to that. So you can see that we have, I'm sorry, this is a typographical error. It should be 40% on that one. Sorry about that. And we can see that it makes a difference to us whether or not we are adherent to that the Lord has told us would be our very best diet. One last question, and then we will close. How does a diabetic with high cholesterol use prunes without having the blood sugar go up? If prunes represent one of the principal sources of sugar, fruit sugar for the person, it will not make the blood sugar go up, you know, unless they eat an enormous amount. All right. We've covered an enormous amount of material. You will not be able to master this material by the lecture, and so that's the reason we have a tape. So we want you to get the tape. There are tapes that are presented, so you can order your tapes and take those home and go over it again. It's a lot of material. I would say probably about 2 months of medical school covered this morning in this lecture. So you can call yourselves physicians now. Shall we stand and have our benediction? Gracious Father, we are overwhelmed with a sense of gratitude for the way that you've provided for us all the delicious things in diet that make it so that we can eat like kings and queens, even in this time when much that we have grown accustomed to in the American cuisine is now suspect of causing disease. Help us to be diligent in studying these things and to learn techniques of cooking that will make it so that our diet can be representative of those who are children of the great King. May we receive from the camp meeting that spiritual blessing that each of us has come here hoping to receive. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. International copyright 2008, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. American Christian Ministries is not a one-man band. It is an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.